Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading some articles from the November-December issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. A Holiday in Verse. He kept tons of lists and stockpiled gifts, cleaned the house and hung the lights, sent cherry cards to distant fam, hoping that they'd book their flights. He watched cheesy movies day and night, queued up all the sappy songs, researched festive recipes, and made shopping lists a mile long. He cataloged his memories from all those Christmases with Gran. There was so much to live up to. Holiday joy required a plan. Hectic days and sleepless nights, the holidays became a slog. I gotta get through Christmas, but I'm as tired as a dog. Would they have enough good wine? Were there plenty comfy seats? Did he buy the special snacks for the cousin who had sworn off meat? Would everyone be happy? Could Christmas magic reappear? If the gathering wasn't perfect, would they skip the whole thing next year? When Christmas Eve came along, the front door was a-swinging. All the family made it in for the laughing and the singing. His plan had come together. He had spared no great expense. But his head was steady pounding, and nothing made much sense. The table set and sat around. The elders shared their tales. A brush with fame and greatness, and entertaining ways they'd failed. He tried so hard to hear them, to focus on every lesson, but, truth be told, he'd longed for bed since Aunt June gave the blessing. All the planning and the worries had done our host no favors. He had worn himself plumb out and was way too spent to savor. But Christmas brings epiphanies. His happened post-dessert. Life should always be this sweet. Loving others shouldn't hurt. He woke on Christmas morning and gave himself a break. He let others grab the coffee and cut leftover cake. He stretched out in his lazy boy as the kiddos ripped through wrapping. And when they started jingle bells, his sore feet started tapping. He looked over at the counter and spied his pile of lists. He couldn't help but chuckle about the joy he had nearly missed. If you enjoyed our amateur attempt at verse or think you can do better, share your finest poems with us at letters@cowboysindians.com. And to get a dose of the real deal, consider heading to the 38th National Cowboy Poetry Gathering, January 30th through February 4th in Elko, Nevada. Mr. Rodeo. Larry Mahan is a legend in and out of the saddle. For all his many accomplishments, the multiple Hall of Famer credits his love of horses and would like to thank the ponies who carried him. By Johnny D. Boggs. The love affair began when Larry Mahan was a kid in Brooks, Oregon. I think my folks bought me my first horse for about $125 when I was probably 7 years old, he says. She was half Arab, half quarter horse, no papers, and we had her around 3 or 4 months, 5 months, and she had a colt. We didn't even know she was bred. And I was just so in love with the horses and riding. He has loved every one of them since, even the rankest broncs that tried to launch him into the stratosphere during 10 rounds of the National Finals Rodeo, rodeo's version of the Super Bowl. He has driven pickups to countless rodeos, a Jaguar through Beverly Hills, and piloted his own twin-engine Cessna 310 across America. He's even soloed at P-51. But the horses, he says, have carried him. to success in rodeo and other arenas, and through the worst of times. It's been an interesting journey, Mahan says, and I'm definitely qualified to be a Rhodes Scholar. The journey includes 8 world championships, 6 all around and 2 bull riding, in the Rodeo Cowboys Association, which became the Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association in 1975. He was the first competitor to qualify in all 3 rough stock events, bull riding and bareback and saddle bronc riding, in the NFR, and set a record that still stands by qualifying 26 times in NFR rough stock events. He was the epitome of being a world champion, says Bill Pierce, who chaired the Frontier Days Rodeo in Prescott, Arizona, from 1966 to 1971. He related to people. He related to his fellow contestants. He was Mr. Rodeo. Mahan followed that with forays into acting. His favorite part was in the 1995 made-for-TV The Good Old Boys, directed by and starring Tommy Lee Jones. Music: Warner Brothers released his LP King of the Rodeo in 1976, and putting his name on Western clothing, boot, and hat lines. Dorfman Milano still produces Larry Mahan hats. Even after his last rodeo, Mahan didn't stop riding. He earned more than $132,500 in National Cutting Horse Association competitions, including a 1989 Derby Non-Professional Reserve Championship, and won the consolation round at the Reno Invitational Team Roping Championship with Sherrick Grantham in 2011. He's been interviewed on television by Johnny Carson, Dick Cavett, Mike Douglas, and Dinah Shore, was host of the TV series Horse World, and wrote a book, Fundamentals of Rodeo Riding, The Mental and Physical Approach to Success. Since 1973, he has slowly been working on an autobiography. He's also the subject of a forthcoming documentary, Teton Ridge Entertainment's The Cowboy, and he remains a leading ambassador for rodeo. Mahan's sitting inside his Spanish-style house, overlooking a beautiful horse facility of 80 acres in Valley View, Texas, which serves as headquarters for the horse and cattle operation. Another ranch lies 2-plus hours north in Ada, Oklahoma. Mahan turned 79 on November 21st. I've had an opportunity to live 4 quarters of the game, and it's in overtime as far as I'm concerned, he says. And you learn to appreciate every day. He's ready to reflect on a life of records and triumphs, broken bones and broken hearts, the good, the bad, and the ugly, and horses. It was, after all, through the love of horses that I got turned on to the rodeo game. In 1957, he entered calf riding at a kid's rodeo and won $6 and a buckle, the latter now displayed at the Pro Rodeo Hall of Fame in Colorado Springs, Colorado. From that point on, he says, I was hooked on the feeling. By the time he turned 15, he had started riding bareback bucking horses and saddle broncs. Armed with a brand new RCA permit in 1960, Mahan entered his first rodeo in Klamath Falls, Oregon. I won the bull riding, he recalls, rode 2 bulls and won $240. That was the beginning of becoming an adrenaline junkie. Out of high school and set on becoming a professional rodeo cowboy, he moved to Arizona in 1962 with his new wife, Darlene, landing a job working in livestock sale yards for $1.10 an hour. Out-of-state tuition dashed the original plan of enrolling at Arizona State University and joining the rodeo team. Instead, Mahan traveled to rodeos, mostly amateur, but a few pro competitions, in Arizona, New Mexico, and occasionally California. He practiced just as much as he could. Many contractors let him ride their bucking stock. In 2002, Harry Vold, a stock contractor for many rodeos, including the NFR, told me that Mahan would ride every animal he could that other competitors had turned out for various reasons. I said, "That shows a lot of determination." Vold quipped, "He was a pain in the ass." Hearing the story, Mahan roars with laughter, then recalls, "Harry was at some rodeo when I jumped on what I thought was a horse another cowboy had turned out, and a cowboy is wondering where his horse is. Harry looks at me and says, 'You little dummy, that's not the horse you're supposed to be on.'" Mahan kept riding, watching, learning, and getting better. In February 1963, he won second in bull riding in El Paso and $852, putting him over the $1,000 threshold and allowing him to join the RCA. That summer, he paid $150 to enroll in 1962 saddle bronc champion Kenny McLean's bronc riding school in British Columbia, riding 49 broncs in 7 days. "I was so sore that I'd take paper plates and ace bandages to wrap around my legs underneath my chaps," he says. It didn't help. On the way home, he stopped to pick apples to pay for the next entry fee for a pro rodeo in Kanaskat, Washington. Boxes were probably 4 feet by 4 feet by four high, he recalls. "You have to pick a lot of apples to fill one of those boxes, and we were paid $4 per box. The school helped my bronc riding, not the apple picking, but I knew for sure I didn't want to be an apple picker." 1964 arrived, and Mahan paid $200 for a roan saddle horse that wanted to buck. He took that horse with him to rodeos. Hauling a practice horse around wasn't the original plan, but before it was over, I'd hauled that horse to several rodeos around the country. If nobody was around, I could tighten up the flank, push the chute gate open, and that horse would buck like crazy, jump and kick for about 7 seconds. I'd then pick up the bronc rein and yell, "Whoa!" He'd stop, and I'd step down off him. He later sold the horse to a friend. Turned out to be a kid's horse. That year, Mahan qualified for his first national finals rodeo in saddle bronc riding in 15th place. He placed third in two go-rounds for about $360, finishing the week-long event in the same slot, 15th. But his mother came to his defense. The Capital Jewel of Salem, Oregon, ran an article about the former local youth turned rodeo rider. The 8 broncs drawn by Mahan during the week-long event included a tough specimen called Trail's End that bucked him off, the newspaper reported. According to Mrs. Weldon Stockton, Mahan's mother, "That particular horse has been a tough ride for every rider. Not many men can stay with him at all," she says. When I read that to Mahan, he laughs. "Oh, my goodness," he says. "Lord, wow, she was quite a gal." 1964 had been a long year. A 1961-ton Ford truck fitted with a wooden horse box, pulling a 19-foot house trailer, mile after mile, town after town, rodeo after rodeo. And the NFR was more of the same. "Parked the old camper out there by the Los Angeles Coliseum," Mahan says. "That was how I rodeoed back then. It wasn't staying at the Hilton or the Broadmoor or any place like that." By 1965, Mahan was traveling with other cowboys, usually leaving Darlene and 3-year-old daughter Lisa at home. Believing that he had a shot at winning the bull riding championship, he started thinking about a better way of getting to rodeos. He and friend Sean Davis, who would win the saddle bronc title that year and again in 1967 and 1968, chartered an airplane to take them from South Dakota to Texas and other rodeos across the country. I instantly fell in love with flying, the technicality, sense of freedom and peaceful aspect of the open skies, Mahan says. He began taking flying lessons. While still leading and bull riding, he hit a slump that summer. Any bull that turned left, the right-handed riding Mahan fell off. After another no score on a good bull, RCA Secretary Treasurer Bill Linderman, the kingpin of the Rodeo Association then, approached Mahan. "I was just in awe that he came up to me," Mahan says. Linderman asked, "Hey, kid, can I give you some advice?" "Yes, sir," Mahan replied. "It sure looks like I need some." Linderman was to the point. "If you want to win a championship, you got to quit falling off." As the season wound down, things improved, and Mahan arrived at the NFR in Oklahoma City with a sizable lead in bull riding. But those 8 go-rounds proved humbling, bucking off 7 bulls and slapping another for a no score. But after the points were tallied, he left the NFR with the coveted engraved gold buckle, 1965 World Champion Bull Rider. He worked harder, mentally and physically. By 1966, he had his pilot's license and was flying to many rodeos. He won the all-around title in 1966, 1967, and 1968 with another bull riding championship in 1967. Jim Shoulder's record for 5 all-around titles set in 1959 became Mahan's target. "I thought that would be a great record to achieve," he says, "so that was my goal." He won all-around titles in 1969 and 1970 to tie the mark. Injuries in 1971 and 72, a season captured in the Academy Award-winning documentary The Great American Cowboy, ended any chance of besting newcomer Phil Lynne. But in 1973, Mahan won the record 6th all-around title. Ty Murray, whom Mahan befriended when Murray was 13, broke it in 1998. "Jim Shoulders set the bar, and I was blessed to have set the bar higher," Mahan says. "I set the bar, and Ty Murray said, 'That's my goal.'" "I was really proud of Ty because I knew how hard he had to work for it in these 3 rough stock events." Mahan quit riding bulls and bareback broncs in 1977, but continued to ride saddle broncs in a few choice events for a few more years before he retired. Well, not really retired. Jim Shoulders said, "When you retire, you usually get a check every month, so you don't retire from rodeo. You just quit," Mahan says. Mahan's last major championship was in saddle bronc riding in Prescott, Arizona in 1979. By the mid-70s, other avenues had opened for Mahan when he met and hired Ted Steinberg, a young sports entertainment attorney in Los Angeles, to negotiate endorsement agreements with various companies eager to add the Mahan name to their product. But Steinberg had other ideas. He persuaded him to form his own brand and label and engage in royalty licensing contracts instead. Whereupon the Larry Mahan Cowboy Collection was trademarked for Western clothing, boots, and hats. That collection gained popularity from Fifth Avenue in New York and across Main Street, USA, to Aspen, Colorado, Santa Fe, New Mexico, Cutter Bills in Dallas and Houston, even Neiman Marcus. Mahan also credits the 1980 movie Urban Cowboy with exploding the Western apparel industry. "It was exciting for me," Mahan says, "because Western apparel represents the Western culture and lifestyle." Steinberg went on to represent many top sports figures, including basketball legend Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, tennis champion Martina Navratilova, and pro football quarterback Craig Morton. Mahan moved to L.A. to study acting, landing parts on TV and in movies after acquiring his Screen Actors Guild card. Then a get-together with music producer Snuff Garrett in Bel Air resulted in the notion that Mahan should cut an album. "He'd invite me over to watch Roy Rogers movies, just the 3 of us, Roy, Snuffy, and me," Mahan recalls. "They'd just finished Roy's last album. I grew up watching Roy Rogers as a kid. I'd go into Salem every chance I could get to watch Roy and Gene Autry on the silver screen. Garrett said, "Mahan, you need to do an album." Mahan wasn't exactly enthusiastic, saying, "Snuffy, I've never had any desire to sing." But Garrett, who had produced Cher, among others, approached Andy Wickham, then heading the artists and repertoire division for Warner Brothers. When they met, Mahan sensed Wickham's reluctance. When Wickham asked Garrett, "Can he sing?" Garrett answered, "Well, if that SOB could sing, do you think he'd be riding bulls for a living?" Shortly afterward, Mahan found himself in a recording studio. A band was hired, a bus purchased, and Mahan was on the road again. He performed at many rodeos where he would come out on a saddle bronc, microphone in hand, and when the pickup man would drop me off, I'd start my first song, which I'd learned from Jerry Jeff Walker. "I'm a rodeo-day-o cowboy, bordering on the insane. Heck, I couldn't make this up." One of his musical highlights came when he opened for Waylon Jennings at Red Rocks Amphitheater near Denver, where Mahan says it became obvious that the crowd of 8,000 screaming fans were there to see Waylon, not me. Mahan had met Jennings and Richie Albright, Jennings' drummer and producer, years earlier in Arizona. "I'd visit them whenever I was in Nashville," he says. "It was fascinating to witness the inner sanctum of Waylon Studio, home of the original outlaw country music star." Another album recorded in Waylon Studio, with Waylon joining the sessions, singing harmony and playing guitar, is still on Mahan's drawing board. It was almost completed in 1979 before Mahan pulled the plug. The reason? "I just really got over my addiction to the road." Because for all of the success, that road had been bumpy. His marriage to Darlene, which produced daughter Lisa and son Ty, hit the rocks in 73, and that was my fault. I'll take credit for that one. I moved to L.A., thought I'd take up acting, got a divorce. Probably made choices that I shouldn't have made, but that was part of my journey. He remarried in 1982, and Robin gave him another daughter, Eliza, in 1987. But that marriage also ended in divorce. So did a third marriage. "The thing that I missed was not being there while the kids were growing up," he says. "But you can't change it now. They all went to college, and I'm proud of all of them." The biggest heartache came on October 4th, 2020, when son Ty died of a heart attack at age 53. That, Mahan says, was devastating. Somehow, horses have always seen him through. He credits the late horseman Ray Hunt and Tom Durance for helping him understand the nature of the creatures. "I'd loved them," he says, "but when I was a young kid, I didn't know how much there was to love." His work on the TV show Horse World also exposed him to other equestrian experts. "It was just part of my educational process to get more knowledge and knowledge and knowledge. That's what I was after." Horses also brought Julianne into his life. In February 2009, Mahan, coming off his third divorce, was taking part in a Cowboys for Christ fundraiser in Ada, Oklahoma. He was on a horse when a slender, pretty, and whip-smart local rancher rode up to him and said, "I hear they're going to auction your ass off today. What do you think it's worth?" She didn't bid on him that night for a day of riding, but he invited her to dinner. They were married on his birthday that November. "I didn't want her to forget my birthday," he jokes. "She's a hand," Mahan says. "She's one of a kind. She's a great rider and totally knowledgeable of horses and cattle. She's keeping me organized. That's a 24/7 deal." And Julianne, close friends and horses, he says, are helping him get through his latest challenge. Last year, a bone marrow biopsy revealed cancer. "That's a showstopper," he says. MD Anderson in Houston was the next stop. "I kept it quiet," Mahan says, "so I could process how to handle it emotionally. and I came to the realization that it's a challenge many people, young and old, have to deal with. And not everybody has horses. Not everybody has cattle. Not everybody has the lifestyle that we have the opportunity to live. So if I can help somebody, let's put it out there. The cancer was caught before it went into leukemia, and as of May, Mahan's cancer has been in remission. Dealing with horses has really helped me deal with that situation, Mahan says. So thank you, ponies, and thank you, God, for creating them. The Cowboy. The Teton Ridge Entertainment documentary about Larry Mahan sneak peeks at NFR. The Cowboy, a documentary from Teton Ridge Entertainment, scheduled for a sneak peek during the December 1 through 10 National Finals Rodeo in Las Vegas, isn't Larry Mahan's first rodeo, so to speak. The Great American Cowboy, 1973, produced and directed by Keith Merrill, focused on the 1972 competition between Mahan and 1971 all-around champion Phil Lynde, who won the 1972 title, too. Mahan captured his sixth all-around title in 1973, breaking the record set by Jim Shoulders in 1959. The Great American Cowboy won the Academy Award for Documentary in 1974. The Cowboy tells Mahan's story, but it's a different kind of documentary. We set out to do something like 2021's All Madden, about National Football League coach and sports commentator John Madden. Kind of a living tribute, says Joe Lavero, Teton Ridge Entertainment president. As we started looking across the landscape of characters to talk to, we realized so many of them have their own great stories, so we're allowing them to tell them. But in doing so, they're paying tribute to the guy who inspired them. Those characters include Ty Murray, whose seventh all-around title in 1998 broke the record set by Mahan and matched by Tom Ferguson in 1979. Bobby DeVecchio, a Bronx native who discovered rodeo in New Jersey at age 14 and later qualified for NFR bull riding from 1980 to 1985. And Charles Charlie Sampson, the first black cowboy to win a world championship bull riding in 1982. Larry has been a multi-generation inspiration for so many cowboys from so many different walks of life, Lavero says. This is generational, this carryover of the greats that all are trying to live up to the standards that Larry set. I always describe Larry as the greatest living cowboy. I've said that for years, and nobody's contradicted me. The Cowboys world premiere is planned for 2023, Lavero says, adding, "We're shooting for the stars here."
Hello, this is Michael, and I'm reading from True West Magazine, November 2022 edition. The Seminole Burnings by Art T. Burton. Deputy U.S. Marshal Bill Tilghman's courageous work was the greatest of his legendary career. The largest and most sensational criminal trial that involved both the Oklahoma and Indian territories prior to statehood in 1907 was known as the Seminole Burnings. Bill Tilghman, one of the most famous lawmen of the area, played a major role in the investigation and prosecution of the crime. The trial was held in Muskogee, and photos show the jury was racially integrated with whites, blacks, and Indians. This case was the only one in the nation at that time in which men were found guilty of a racial lynching and sent to jail. It didn't happen again until late in the 20th century. As great as his law enforcement career was, I feel this was the most important detective work Tilghman was ever involved in on the Western frontier. The United States Congress, the Secretary of War Department, and the U.S. Attorney General took part in the effort to restore peace and bring members of the mob to trial. The Secretary of the Interior directed the work of investigating claims and making indemnity payments to the Seminole Indians. Mystery Killer. On Thursday, December 30th, 1897, a murder was committed near the western border of the Seminole Nation. Julius Laird and his family were tenant farmers in the Seminole Nation, leasing land from Thomas McGeisey, superintendent of Seminole Nation schools. The Laird house was 3 miles east of the Oklahoma Territory line and 1 mile west of the McGeisey home. Laird and his family, who lived in Pottawatomie County, had been involved in the illegal whiskey trade in the Indian Territory. Bass Reeves, the famous black deputy U.S. Marshal, whose beat included the Creek and Seminole Nations, described Julius Laird as a regular whiskey peddler who had been in business for some time. On the morning of December 30th, Julius Laird had gone to help his brother Herschel Garrett gather corn on his farm located 3 miles south of Maud, Oklahoma Territory, and 6 miles west of Julius's farm. Mary Laird, Julius's wife, stayed at their farm in the Seminole Nation with their 4 children. Frank, 8 years old. Sudie, 6 years old. Nanny, 5 years old. And the baby, Cora. Julius had left his family alone at the house on other occasions. The surrounding country was quiet and peaceful, and the McGeiseys lived only a mile away. The Lairds were the only white family living in that part of the Seminole Nation, but had many families and friends living around Maud. O.T., the Laird farm, was about 18 miles southeast of Tecumseh, at that time the principal town in Pottawatomie County. About an hour before sunset on December 30th, 1897, an Indian on a bay pony with a roached mane rode up to the Laird farm. Mrs. Laird and her 4 children did not recognize him. The stranger was well-built, rather stocky, and had a scar on one cheek. After entering the yard and approaching the house, the Indian told Mrs. Laird that he needed to borrow a saddle, for he was riding without one. Mrs. Laird informed him that since she didn't know him, she couldn't loan him a saddle, and her husband wasn't home at the time. Mary Laird allowed the stranger to get a drink of water. She became suspicious and turned her bulldog loose, but the dog went after some loose hogs in the yard instead of confronting the stranger. Mrs. Laird at that point went into the house and got a rifle. The Indian took note and hurriedly mounted his pony and rode west. About half an hour later, Mrs. Laird and children were preparing to eat dinner. The Indian reappeared. Frank saw him first and ran and told his mother that the Indian boy was back. The Indian entered the house, and Mrs. Laird picked up the baby Cora and ran out the south door of the house. The Indian grabbed the rifle Mrs. Laird had used to threaten him with earlier. He tried to shoot her several times, but the rifle had no cartridges in it. The Indian chased Mrs. Laird around the yard, caught up with her, and hit her over the head with the rifle butt. It was a killing blow. Mrs. Laird fell on top of her baby. The stranger moved Mrs. Laird's lifeless body and grabbed the baby with one arm and threw her viciously onto the floor of the house's porch. The Indian asked the children about money. Little Frank told him his father had all the money on his person. The Indian walked out of the yard and rode into the darkness. The next morning, the Laird children, with the seriously injured baby, went toward Maud for help. They arrived in town at about 10 a.m. The townspeople located Julius, who was on his way back home after spending a night with his brother. As Julius and a small party arrived at his farm, they found his wife's body in the front yard. During the night, the hogs in the yard had smelled the blood and nearly devoured Mrs. Laird's head and neck. Julius Laird and his friend at once began putting together a posse to locate the killer or killers. Laird did not know a big Indian with a scar or one who rode a bay horse with a roached mane. The posse made up of white men from Pottawatomie County, Oklahoma Territory. The posse becomes a mob. The leadership of the posse was given to Nelson M. Jones, a white deputy U.S. Marshal of the Muskogee Federal Court, who was stationed in the Seminole Nation by U.S. Marshal Leo E. Bennett. The week of December 31st, 1897 to January 7th, 1898, the posse arrested and detained just about every young Indian male they could find. The Laird children couldn't identify any of the Indians who were questioned. Some of the Indians who were picked up were tortured by the posse and rearrested later. Several Seminole Light Horse police officers were disarmed and detained by the posse. The posse became more and more angry as they became frustrated about not being able to find the guilty party. With plenty of alcohol for the posse, the men soon became a large, unruly mob. No official notification of the murder or of the posse's activities was sent to the Seminole Nation officials. The method of the mob was to ride along all roads near the border and take every Indian male they found to the Laird house for possible identification of the guilty person by the boy, Frank Laird. The leader of the mob was Samuel V. Pryor. Born in Mississippi, he claimed to be a former Texas Ranger. His authority superseded Deputy U.S. Marshal Nelson M. Jones, who couldn't control the mob. Jones, surprisingly, never attempted to contact his superior, Marshal Leo E. Bennett, at Muskogee. The mob set up headquarters at Laird's Farm in the Seminole Nation. Although they couldn't find who the murderer was, they decided someone was going to die for the crime. Pryor had bragged about his expertise in lynching blacks in Texas. The mob chose Palmer Sampson, a full-blood Seminole who could not speak or understand English, and Lincoln McGeezy, Thomas's son, as their victims to be lynched. The mob from Pottawatomi had grown to about 200 persons bent on revenge. The story now not only had Mrs. Laird being murdered, but also raped, which was false. It was true, though, that her baby died from inflicted injuries. With Sam Pryor in command, the mob took McGeezy and Sampson to a brush arbor known as the Tabernacle, half a mile south of the mob post office. This occurred on Friday night, January 7th, 1898. At about 2 a.m. on January 8th, the innocent Seminole boys were tied to trees with chains and burned alive. There were three white ministers present at the burning. Initially, all the newspapers in Pottawatomi County supported the mob and endorsed the notion that the real culprits had been punished. The United States government took a different view and decided to punish the members of the mob. At first, things went rather slowly, but by April, a special prosecutor was named, Horace Speed, one of the most important Republicans in the Oklahoma Territory. It was decided that the prosecution and trial would be a joint effort between the twin territories. The trial would take place in Muskogee, Indian Territory, with Judge R. Thomas presiding. There were many deputy U.S. marshals assigned to the case, which was given the highest priority by federal officials. Speed, being a former U.S. attorney for the Western District of Oklahoma, was highly thought of as being very capable. The United States Congress voted a special appropriation of $40,000 to find and punish the mob murderers. Bill Tilghman was made the principal investigator with the federal government. Complicit in crime. Deputy U.S. Marshal Bill Tilghman, early on, arrested Deputy U.S. Marshal Nelson M. Jones for complicity in the crime. Other veteran lawmen assigned to the case included Tilghman's close friend Heck Thomas, William Fawcett, N. M. Douglas, W. F. Jones, and Tilghman's longtime posseman Neil Brown, who had assisted Tilghman during his Cowtown lawman days in Dodge City. Tilghman's wife, Zoe, wrote about the case. For many days, Bill rode through the rough Blackjack Hills and tangled bottoms of the North Canadian. He stopped at cabins, meeting sullen answers and glowering looks. He asked for a meal. He was turned away. Twice, a bullet ripped through the leaves above him or threw dirt up in the road. Mrs. Tilghman stated also that While gathering evidence, Bill and Heck Thomas rode in a spring wagon with their own food and camp equipment. One of them always rode in the back of the wagon with his Winchester rifle ready, watching their backs. Zoe Tilghman wrote that this case was one of the most dangerous assignments Bill ever had in the territory. Tilghman and Thomas were successful in arresting 15 members of the mob. 69 people were eventually indicted for mob action regarding the burning. Deputy U.S. Marshal Nelson M. Jones was convicted at Muskogee and sentenced to serve 21 years in the Missouri State Penitentiary. Andrew J. Mathias was sentenced to 10 years in the federal penitentiary at Leavenworth, Kansas. Mont Ballard served 7 years of a 10-year sentence at Leavenworth. George Bird Ivanhoe and Sam Pryor were sentenced to 3-year terms of imprisonment. Pryor began his time in Leavenworth, but was transferred to Ohio State Penitentiary. This was the first time the federal government indicted, arrested, and convicted parties for racial lynching in U.S. history. Seminole Indians who suffered at the hands of the mob filed personal injury claims. 24 members of the tribe received payments that varied from $25 for those who were arrested and detained to a sum over $5,000 to the heirs of the Indians who were killed. 4 members of the Seminole Light Horse Police who had been detained were paid $50 each. The real killer. Regarding the actual murderer of Mrs. Laird, Bill Tilghman continued to follow up on leads in the case. A 23-year-old Seminole Indian named Keno Harjo had allegedly confessed to the crime in a letter to his sister, a student at Emahaka Mission School. Keno claimed he had killed Mrs. Laird and then fled. His sister informed authorities about the letter and where Keno was hiding out. Bill Tilghman and his posse spent 22 days hunting Keno down in the territory. They finally captured him in the Chickasaw Nation and placed him in the federal jail in Guthrie. Keno Harjo's father had traded the bay pony to a Seminole medicine man, or murder medicine, that is, a charm against being haunted by the ghost of a victim. Bill Tilghman located several persons who had seen the Harjo pony, a bay pacer with a roached mane, in the vicinity of the Laird home on the day of the murder. Keno had traded his saddle for a jug of whiskey at Violet Springs, then ridden to his uncle's house, which took him past the Laird farm. Young Harjo was given bond, and his case never came up for trial. The federal authorities eventually had to set him free for lack of evidence against him. Deputy U.S. Marshal Bill Tilghman did an outstanding job in tracking down mob members and apparently the actual murderer in this sensational Twin Territories criminal case. True West Magazine Archives, July 1989 edition. Great Western Gunfights. The Medicine Lodge Bank Robbery. April 30th, 1884, Medicine Lodge, Kansas. By Bill O'Neill. One of the bloodiest and most sensational bank robberies in the history of the West involved a lethal gunfighter named Henry Brown. Brown was born in 1857 in Missouri. Orphaned at a young age, he headed west when he was 17. For a time, he worked on a ranch in eastern Colorado. Then he spent a season hunting buffalo. In 1876, he killed a man in the Texas Panhandle, pumping 3 slugs into his adversary. Subsequently, he gravitated toward turbulent Lincoln County, New Mexico, where he fought in most of the skirmishes and battles of the Lincoln County War. Brown was a close companion of Billy the Kid, and in the aftermath of the Lincoln County War, he leagued with the Kid and other fugitives who formed a band of stock thieves. After the gang drove a herd of stolen horses to Tascosa, Brown seemed to exhibit a change in character. He pinned on a deputy's badge in Tascosa and later was an Oldham County deputy sheriff. Next, he was hired by Barney O'Connor, foreman of a ranch in Woods County, Oklahoma. But shortly, he was appointed deputy marshal of Caldwell, a wild trail town just across the Kansas line. Within a few months, he was promoted to city marshal, and promptly, he tamed the tough little town which had witnessed the shooting deaths of four officers. He imported a Texas hard case called Ben Wheeler, whose real name was Ben Robertson, to be his deputy. On New Year's Day, 1883, Brown was presented a new Winchester with a silver plate saluting his valuable services to the citizens of Caldwell, Kansas. And in the ensuing months, he killed two troublemakers in separate shootouts. Brown was married in March 1884. He bought a house and furniture, and for the first time in his life, went deeply in debt. Within a few weeks, Brown and Wheeler decided to rob the Medicine Valley Bank in Medicine Lodge, 70 miles to the west, and near the ranch where he had been employed by Barney O'Connor. Brown and Wheeler left Caldwell on a Sunday afternoon after having obtained permission from the mayor to spend a few days in Oklahoma in search of a murderer. The next day, they were joined by two cowboys, William Smith and John Wesley, and the four men headed for Medicine Lodge. On Wednesday morning, April 30th, 1884, they staked fresh mounts in a canyon in the Gypsum Hills, a few miles south of Medicine Lodge, and then they rode into town, arriving during a driving rain a little after 9 o'clock. Leaving Smith with the horses, Brown, Wheeler, and Wesley entered the two-story brick bank building and confronted the two men present, President E.W. Payne and cashier George W. Geppert, with the demand for money. Even though Brown had him covered with an engraved Winchester, Payne defiantly reached for a pistol. Brown fatally wounded him with one shot, whereupon Wheeler and Wesley pumped two bullets into Geppert, who had raised his hands. Geppert staggered to the vault and threw the lock, then slid to a sitting position and died. Gunfire erupted outside as Smith began to trade shots with City Marshal Sam Dinn and other citizens. With the town aroused, there was no time to force the lock, so Brown let a break for the horses. After a panicky moment of fumbling with wet leather reins, the outlaws swung into their saddles and spurred their mounts south down Main Street and set a course for the Gyp Hills. Across the street from the bank, a dozen or more cowboys with saddled horses were waiting for the rain to let up so that they could begin work on a large roundup. At the sound of gunfire, they mounted up and rode out in close pursuit of the outlaws. The furious pace rapidly exhausted Ben Wheeler's thoroughbred, and he abandoned his mount to ride double. The fugitives left the road and galloped west toward the hills. But instead of riding into the gap where their remounts were staked out, the outlaws mistakenly entered the only box canyon in Gyp Hills. Leading the posse was Barney O'Connor, who spurred his mount toward the mouth of what would become known as Jackass Canyon. O'Connor leaped off his horse and darted for cover as other posse members approached. With escape blocked, the outlaws dismounted and sought shelter over the grassy floor of the ravine. Several cowboys reinforced O'Connor at the entrance of the Box Canyon, while the others scrambled up to the muddy heights to gain sniper positions. A fierce gun battle erupted, but all parties had concealed themselves so well that no one was wounded. The outlaws were trapped, however, and to make matters worse, rain was slowly filling the canyon with runoff water. After 2 hours, Brown threw out his guns, asked for protection, and walked forward, followed by his three accomplices. In Medicine Lodge, infuriated townspeople met the prisoners with threats of lynching, and the outlaws were thrown into a log building under guard. The county sheriff and town marshal could muster only a single pair of handcuffs and one set of leg irons. On one end of the leg irons was fastened to Wesley's left ankle, the other to Brown's right leg. The cuffs were manacled to Wheeler's right wrist and Smith's left. The captives ate two meals during the day, had their pictures taken, and Brown wrote a letter to his unsuspecting bride, lamely stating that it was all for you, and that I did not think this would happen. About 9 p.m., three shots were fired and a mob overpowered the guards and opened the jail. But Brown had freed himself simply by removing his right boot, while Smith had managed to slip his hand through the cuffs. When the door was flung open, Brown darted through the surprised lynch mob into an alley. Just as he broke into the clear, a farmer named Billy Kelly triggered both barrels of his shotgun. Cut almost in half by the double blast of buckshot, Brown crumpled into the dirt nearly 50 yards from the jail. Several other shots were fired into his body, and he died on the spot. When the mob turned toward Brown, Ben Wheeler seized his own chance for freedom. As Wheeler tore through the crowd, a gun was discharged at point-blank range. Wheeler staggered with the impact, and the muzzle blast ignited his vest, but he frantically kept his legs pumping. As he fled into the darkness, his figure was illuminated by his flaming vest, and he was followed by a fusillade of gunfire. A bullet ripped two fingers from his left hand, then a Winchester slug shattered his right arm. Still, he tumbled forward another 100 yards. The mob surged after him, firing on the run. Bullets chunked into his back, and he finally fell, to be pounced upon almost immediately by his pursuers. Back at the jail, Smith and Wesley also tried to escape, but advanced only a few feet before they were seized. Eager hands shoved them toward the creek bed a few hundred yards east of the jail, where a grove of trees flourished in the bottomland. The stunned, bleeding Wheeler was jerked to his feet and pushed alongside Smith and Wesley beneath a particularly large elm. Wheeler whispered a confession, then screamed pitifully as nooses were readied. His pleas for mercy were ignored. When Wesley was pressed for last words, in a trembling voice, he breathed that he had a mother in Texas and asked that she not be told his fate. He added that he had been born in 1853 in Paris, Texas, and asked that friends in Vernon, Texas, be told of his death. Smith disdainfully showed no fear. He requested that his horse, saddle, and personal possessions be sold and the money forwarded to his mother in Vernon. The nooses were placed around the three men's necks, and the ends of the 3/4-inch lariat ropes were tossed over a stout limb about 15 feet high. Wheeler wailed so loudly that he was heard blocks away. The three men were strung up and left dangling through the night. On Thursday morning, the bodies were displayed side by side in the lot west of the jail. Word of the lynching had spread rapidly, and all day the curious came into town to view the executed felons. Souvenir hunters stripped limbs from the hanging tree and sliced the three lariat ropes into small pieces. A coroner's jury decreed that the criminals had died at the hands of unknown parties. Later in the day, the shrouded bodies were laid into pine coffins, which were loaded into a wagon and hauled to the little graveyard a mile northwest of town. It was not considered proper to bury the outlaws alongside decent citizens, so a large hole was dug just outside the western boundary of the cemetery. Quickly, the four pine boxes were lowered into the common grave and covered with freshly turned dirt. Western Legends, True West Magazine, November 2022 edition, by Steve Friesen. The Rock Island auction hammers out Wild West shootists' sidearms. The Rock Island Premier Firearms Auction, held August 26th through the 28th, included notable weapons from legendary characters of the Old West and beyond. Among those characters were two staunch friends of William F. Buffalo Bill Cody. One was Wild Bill Hickok, who a teenaged Cody met on a wagon train along the Oregon Trail. Their lives intertwined from that moment until Hickok's death in 1876. The other was Frank North, a fellow scout with Cody during the Indian Wars. North later purchased a Nebraska ranch with Cody and helped him begin his Wild West show. Weapons from Hickok and North were represented in the auction. James Butler, Wild Bill Hickok's Smith & Wesson Model 2 Army Revolver was presented at the auction with extensive provenance. That included information suggesting it was on him when he was killed in 1876, just 2 years after he performed on stage with Cody in Buffalo Bill's Combination. The revolver brought $235,000. Frank North's reputation was overshadowed by that of his friend Buffalo Bill, yet he too was an important scout during the Indian Wars. His Remington Improved New Model Navy Revolver was manufactured between 1870 and 1875. It was inscribed and presented to him by Cody, probably while North was with Buffalo Bill's Wild West. Like the Hickok revolver, this firearm also had very strong provenance and sold for $49,938. Buffalo Bill, Wild Bill Hickok, and Frank North were all part of the true West, but helped create the myth of the West. It was a myth that influenced Western movies and TV shows, even science fiction. The swashbuckling heroes of the Star Wars movies wore pistols on their hips and brandished sabers. A Mauser C-96 converted by the studio armorers to become a DL-44 heavy blaster pistol was used by Harrison Ford as Han Solo in the first Star Wars movie. It sold for $1,057,500 at the Rock Island auction. There were, of course, other handguns, rifles, and accessories, including rare Winchesters and even a Colt Gatling gun. Altogether, the 2022 Premier Firearms Auction, with 3,706 lots, brought in $23,025,594, with the high prices realized by firearms associated with legends of the past and the future. The auction demonstrated that the myth of the West, even a West set a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, continues to fascinate collectors.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.